Thank you and welcome to the third panel of today's meeting of the Philadelphia Society. Our subject today is Beyond Legal Positivism. The belief that all political knowledge can be reduced to a science is the theme and the illusion of modern political philosophy dating back to Hobbes. During the 19th century, the physical sciences achieved an unprecedented prestige. This was a period of countless inventions, technological advancement, and economic prosperity. To many Western intellectuals, the political application of scientific discoveries seemed to herald the dawn of the millennium. The 18th century promise of an early utopia seemed definitely within the reach of man's power. The method had been found. Paradise on earth waited only upon the proper execution of the plan to be discovered in the truths and with the methods of the natural sciences. It was to science that the 19th century turned for understanding and salvation, just as men in the Middle Ages had turned to theology and to the church. Technical efficiency and mechanical certainty were the ideals of the 19th century, and they were the ideals not only of the scientists, but of the intelligentsia in general, who looked to a science of history, a science of law, a science of society, which we now call sociology, a science of government, and even a science of evolution and race. Hence was born positivism. Herein lies the germinating source, or more precisely, one of the sources of the Marxist and Nazi mind, of modern behavioralism, totalitarianism, and of our subject today, legal positivism. Legal positivism is an attempt to transfer to the study of law the methods and concepts of natural sciences in the belief that legal phenomena, like physical phenomena, obey certain laws of nature, which can be inductively discovered by the empirical examination of successive events. With the rise of positivism in the 19th century, the only task left to social science and jurisprudence is the description of events and the induction from those events of general laws of causality, the evaluation of the goodness or badness, justice or injustice, of particular events being regarded not only as irrelevant, but as being incompatible with scientific methods and ideals. In an effort to confine himself to the pure description of empirically observable facts, the positivist substitutes the inductive reasoning of the physical scientist for the right reason of the 17th century philosopher. In a word, positivism is an attempt to substitute an immanent conception of order for the earlier transcendental conception, an attempt to substitute the physical laws of nature for the natural law of reason. When the classical liberal theory of law was subjected to the positivist scrutiny, only the subjective part of that theory survived. The classical liberal theory of law merged two self-sufficient theories of law. On the one hand, the theory of law that is the product of individual will, its ultimate sanction consisting of the force behind it. And on the other hand, the theory that law is the embodiment of principles discoverable by reason, the obligation to obey it derived from the inherent justness of its content. When focused from the perspective of positivism, only the former subjective theory remained. Justice, being a metaphysical concept, was discarded as being empirically worthless. Since reason was denied the capacity of discovering the principles of justice, its function was confined to an analysis of the existing law in the belief that positive law is the only true law. The criteria of law became the manner of enactment and the force behind it. Any command that issued from a legislature or other organ of government empowered to issue commands in accordance with a prescribed procedure with sufficient force behind it to compel obedience was law and was the only true law. Freedom under the law was retained by the positivist liberal as an article of his liberal faith, but it came to mean something quite different from what it had meant originally. Originally, it meant that a man could not be compelled to do anything contrary to reason or conscience, that the test of the law was its justness. Under the influence of positivism, the concept came to mean that a man could not be compelled to do anything except by a law enacted in accordance with a prescribed procedure, any procedure, with sufficient force behind it to compel obedience. There is a great difference, of course, between freedom from unjust compulsion and freedom from illegal compulsion. When the test of legality, moreover, is ultimately conceived as the force behind the law, freedom from illegal compulsion amounts to no more than freedom to do whatever the state does not forbid. This is a conception of freedom, much more congenial to tyranny, of course, than to the preservation of the rights of man. Precisely when this sort of nonsense began to influence the study of law in America is not certain, but the adoption of the case method of legal study at Harvard Law School in the 1870s is probably the clearest point of origin. By studying actual court decisions rather than commentaries or legal philosophy, the new lawyer might approach the law as a science of jurisprudence. The law was what the legislature or the judge said it was. The whole case method of legal study today is indeed based on positivistic assumptions. By the turn of the century, legal positivism in America had risen to a whole new theory of jurisprudence, which came to be known as legal realism. John Chipman Gray's work entitled The Nature and Sources of Law, published in 1909, was the opening salvo. Gray argued that the law is not an ideal, but is made up of the rules for decision which the courts lay down. Moreover, it is the fact that the courts apply rules that makes those rules law. Rather than being discoverers of the law, the judges are creators of the law. The sources of law upon which the judges draw are statutes, judicial precedents, expert opinions, even customs and moral principles. But these do not become law until they are embodied in judicial decisions. Herein lie the seeds of judicial supremacy. From Gray's suggestion that the law is what the judges say, his successors proceeded to derive the conclusion that law is what the judges do. And modern legal realism is concerned primarily with the analysis of judicial behavior. Contemporary legal realism is associated with the names of Carl Llewellyn, Jerome Frank, and above all, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who served on the Supreme Court for 30 years. It was Holmes who maintained that every word of moral significance should be banished from the law altogether, and insisted that truth is unknowable except in the natural sciences. The legal realists, in one form or another, still dominate the thinking of our courts, our law firms, and our law schools. But I submit to you that law is too important a subject to be left to the lawyers. The great misfortune of American jurisprudence today is that it has not been subjected to careful scrutiny by our great thinkers and has been left to the lawyers themselves, a profession that is, I can assure you, in large measure philosophically illiterate. We have made great progress over the last 30 years in the field of political philosophy toward a recovery of the wisdom of the past. When the students of Leo Strauss, Gerhard Niemeyer, Eric Verglen, Wilmer Kendall, Friedrich Hayek, John Halliwell, and other great minds of our time turn more of their attention to modern legal philosophy and jurisprudence, I am confident that we shall witness a rebirth of freedom under law, a rebirth of our Constitution and limited government. Already, I am pleased to report Dr. Russell Kirk, our distinguished president of the Philadelphia Society, is busily preparing for the Center for Judicial Studies a monograph on modern legal philosophy in the great tradition of his conservative mind. This is a study that will surely stimulate a rethinking of the theoretical assumptions upon which our present legal system rests and help us get beyond legal positivism. Moving now to our panelists for today, we offer food for thought on three manifestations of intellectual bankruptcy in American jurisprudence. Professor Gary McDowell of Tulane University will address the problem of constitutional study and scholarship. Professor William Harvey of the Indiana Law School will show how the law, once a means of providing equal justice, has been politicized using the Legal Services Corporation and as an example of the decline of rule of law in modern America. And Professor William Crystal of the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard will give us a peek into the future course of legal philosophy, a study of the law school as a Marxist training ground in contemporary America. Without further ado, I shall turn over the podium to Professor McDowell.